This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. We aim to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the president of Scaled Composites, as well as the VP of Flight Operations. In the news, Boeing is told by the FAA to make a plan. The airframer is looking to reacquire Spirit AeroSystems. Skyrise is taking deposits for a fly-by-wire helicopter. The V-22 Osprey should be returning to flight. Airlines are scaling back pilot hiring. And the JetBlue and Spirit merger is dead. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 789 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me is first our main man, Micah.
Hey, great to be here, and I'm looking forward to a really interesting composite show.
Oh, very good. Also with us is Rob Mark. He's a business jet pilot, a journalist, and publisher of Jetwine.com.
Hey, good evening to everybody, and for our guests, I'm sorry I'm wearing this Pilatus hat, but I didn't get my scaled hat. And, you know, what can I tell you? I mean, I promised the guys at Pilatus that I'd wear this whenever I could. So,
can I just point out that I also happen to be wearing a G650 hat because I don't have a scaled hat?
I think there's a movement here starting.
No pressure or anything, right?
Right, right. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft, and he's not wearing a hat.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what's up with hats? I mean, everybody's indoors here. I mean, I'm not scared of letting people see that, yeah, I'm kind of bald on top, and there's no bright lights of the glare of the theater on me. So what's up with these hats anyway?
I don't know.
My headphones stick to my bald head.
Well, there's a good reason right there. All right. Well, David Vanderhoof is off this week. Hopefully he will return to join us next week. And this week we have two guests. Our guests are first Greg Morris. He's president of Scaled Composites. And also with us is their VP of Flight Operations, Pete Siebold. Now, of course, I think everybody listening to this is probably well aware of Scaled Composites, the aerospace company founded by Burt Rutan, and they develop experimental aircraft. They're currently owned by Northrop Grumman, located at the Mojave Air and Spaceport in California, and Scaled focuses on designing and developing concept aircraft. I think they're best known for what can be described as unconventional concept aircraft in many ways. So first, Greg Morris. He joined Scaled in 2023 from Gauntlet Aerospace, where he was president and chief test pilot. He operated a flight school for 7 years, had 10 years of experience in flight test operations. Interestingly, Greg also taught in the Qualitative Evaluation Program for the United States Air Force Test Pilot School. He's a nationally designated FAA experimental examiner. And he's conducted check rides for a variety of aircraft, both Scaled Composites and others. So, Greg, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Thanks very much. It's been an impactful 9 years since I was on last, but very happy to be here again.
It's hard to imagine that it's been 9 years. So we're very happy to have you with us. Also joining us is Peter Siebold. As I mentioned, he's the VP of Flight Operations at Scaled. He joined the company in 1996 as a design engineer on the Visionaire Vantage. He's worked extensively as a flight test engineer on many programs before becoming a test pilot for the company. And during his time at Scaled, Pete has held multiple leadership positions within engineering and flight operations, including director of flight operations. And he's flown 4 first flights at Scaled and 11 different scaled aircraft. How cool is that? Pete, we're very happy to have you with us.
Max, thank you. And it's a pleasure and looking forward to the conversation.
So keeping up the tradition, you can expect to hear from us maybe in 9 years from now, and we'll try to catch up with you. How's that? All right. Well, let's jump right in. Scaled Composites. What a fascinating company. long history of producing fascinating aircraft and spacecraft. Greg, let's start with you. What's the magic sauce? How does a company like Scaled continuously innovate in the way that you have?
That was one thing I was really interested in when I joined Scaled. So when I graduated from engineering school back in 2004, I sent a resume to one company for an engineering job, and it was to Scaled. I did not get hired. In fact, I didn't even get a call back, right? So it also has now happened that the joke in the company is if you apply and then wait 19 years, things usually work out for you. But I was really interested when I joined the company to kind of figure out exactly like what's the magic of Scaled? What's the secret sauce there? And the secret of Scaled is there is no secret except take incredibly dedicated people who are really passionate about the mission, put them in the desert where they have nothing to do but build amazing airplanes and turn them loose. So, I mean, my core job, right, is just stay out of their way, to empower our people and stay out of their way. And I wish I could say that there was anything else, but that creativity is so amazing to watch. I'm the worst engineer in the company, and I recognize this. And I say this as one of the best engineers in the company with Pete next to me as well. So I think he can also be great to expand on this a little bit from all his experience in watching, you know, working for Burt and the transition as well.
Yeah, Pete, tell us a little bit about, you know, what you've seen over the years. Is the magic something that's was there from the beginning and just kind of continued through time, or has it developed along the way?
You know, it really has. The you know, obviously, when I started, I came fresh out of school and working for Burt Rutan. That was just a phenomenal experience. And my goal was just to try and keep up with him. And that was quite a journey and at times a wild ride and something that, you know, I look back at just very fondly. You know, the people that work here, if you can summarize them, they're hands-on generalists. They are doing what they do at work here. They're doing exactly what they do at home in the evenings and on the weekends. And, you know, if there was one way to summarize, you know, the average Scaled employee is just dedicated and excited about what we do and what our mission is.
Yeah, if I can build on that a little bit right now, I'll walk through here in the weekend and we've got some machine shop spaces and 3D printers and likes for use for our employees for side projects. And you've had somebody who's been working all week designing an aircraft, working on the shop floor with the fabricators. And I walk through on a Saturday and they're here grinding their transponder tray for their long easy. It's just everybody is doing exactly what they want to be. And I'm so fortunate to be in the environment.
I think that's a great thing for a company to do. When I was at Hewlett-Packard, they told engineers that they could set aside 10% of their time to work on, you know, fun personal kinds of things. And I think Google also has done something similar to that. And I just look at the amount of innovation that comes from doing that. I mean, have you seen good results from that?
We actually don't set aside time for engineers to do that. Now they're all going to ask for that. So I really appreciate that, Max. Thanks. You've just blown up all my numbers. So cool. Happy I'll send help. You a bill. Don't worry. I work fully burdened rate, too. It's going to be awesome.
So they do this on the
But road. These are people actually on their own time that are coming in again to do these side projects and to grow and to keep learning. And it is just fantastic to watch. It's super cool.
It allows our employees to do is maybe to branch out into fields that they don't have previous experience in. And so coming in on the weekends, maybe a mechanical engineer is breaking out the soldering station and the electronics test equipment, working on their avionics on their airplane. And before you know it, they're a little bit more than just a mechanical engineer. They actually know how to make sparks fly on our airplanes.
How many of the people that work there are aircraft owners themselves?
A significant number. We actually had one who just flew their Lancair for the first time 2 weeks ago. But we have an aviation benefit as well to help encourage that. So we've got an aviation benefit to encourage folks in the company to pursue flying. So we give them some money every year to be able to do that. But I think in flight operations, Pete, it's more than half, I think, are aircraft owners or pilots. And in engineering, about the same. So huge, huge push of engineers. We have their fly-out lunches every couple Fridays. And the number of aircraft just departing Mojave to go fly somewhere else is significant.
I was wondering if you could scaled for us. Give us a feel for how many people there are. Any other metrics that you would use to kind of describe the company?
Yeah, about 275 employees, 100 fabricators in the shop, about 50 in engineering, and about 15-ish in flight tests between test pilots and flight test engineers. and then the balance in support functions. We've got more than 20 active programs going on at a given time, which really gives you a sense also of how much responsibility is pushed down to an individual engineer as part of that process. You know, somebody who's just a few years out of school will have an incredible scope of what they're being asked to do at a given time.
And I'm curious, with 20 active projects, how many of those are projects that have been contracted, you know, by someone else? They've come to you and said, hey, do this for us, versus how many are ones that you're doing kind of on your own, kind of speculative?
Really all are. Well, so this is part of where being, you know, we're owned by Northrop Grumman, right? So part of that is we do a lot of work for other areas of Northrop in that development and partnership with them to help them develop new concepts, mature systems that then will transition into other parts of Northrop for further development.
You know, you're both engineers and you're both pilots. What kind of engineers are you, and how did flying get into your engineering studies?
Great question. You know, my flying started as a young child. My father actually set the bug, and he was a pilot as a hobby. It was not his profession. And, you know, I grew up, you know, as most engineers do, taking everything apart and not putting anything back together until I was a certain age where it all clicked. And I knew that I was going to do something with flying. And, but I also knew that I needed to do something with my engineering background and interests. And so I studied aerospace engineering at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, and came straight to work here out of Cal Poly SLO, and started working on the Vision Air Vantage program as a flight test engineer. And that's really how it all started. I was fortunate when I was in college, I was a flight instructor. And so I got to teach a lot of my fellow students and classmates how to fly. And that was really just a great experience as a engineer to be, and then also as a young CFI to get into the world of flying.
You'll be thrilled to know I was just at San Luis Obispo about 4 hours ago.
Oh, very good.
My undergrad's also in aerospace engineering, and I also started flying before I went to college. So I was fortunate enough to actually flight instruct through most of college. And I got a master's from National Test Pilot School in flight test engineering later. And for me, it was the same kind of thing. I always loved airplanes. You know, I always joke, every little boy goes through the phase, I love dinosaurs and then trucks and then trains. My airplane phase has been going on for 35 years so far. So at some point, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to cycle back to dinosaurs and have to redecorate my office completely, but it'll be fine.
No, you never have to grow up. You can be a kid forever. That's the nice thing about aviation.
Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah. Pete, maybe you can tell us a little bit about some of the aircraft where you flew on their first flights, and what's that experience like?
Yeah, you know, a first flight is just an overwhelming experience for the company as a whole. A lot of effort has gone into the design, the fabrication, and then ultimately the testing of that platform. And as a pilot, as a first flight pilot, you get to be at the tip of the spear, but it really just reflects the hard work that that the entire company has put into the project. You know, a first flight is one of unknowns. Our primary goal is to safely get the airplane back on the ground. And we often and talk about it and brief it that the primary goal on this first flight is a safe and successful landing. In the end, when you're behind the stick and you push the throttle forward, it's all business. You've got a job to do. You're learning a brand new airplane without a CFI sitting next to you. And you get to learn just enough about the airplane to feel comfortable about bringing it back into the pattern and having that landing, and then ultimately the big celebration with the team.
How much of all of this sort of thing can you evaluate ahead of time with simulation or in the wind tunnel? I mean, I don't know how you quantify this, but, you know, and how much of it you just have to discover with the aircraft itself?
You know, that's part of the essence of flight test, and the science behind flight test is we have to be prepared for the unknown. We know things are not going to go according to plan. We try and minimize as much of those risks as we can in the design process, but we ultimately know this isn't a perfect science. And what we focus on in our preparations for first flights are understanding where the risks are. And so the flight control the rudder instability was actually a great example of that. We fully anticipated that there could be an instability, and we didn't know it was going to be the rudder. We didn't know. We thought it might be the ailerons. We thought it might be the elevator. And so we trained. We actually had a full simulator. It was fixed-based, but control loading capabilities where we could model the hinge moments and the feel of the aircraft. And so we trained, and through multiple failures in where we would be thrown a failure that would result in an unstable control surface. And we had to, as a team, including the control room, learn how to fly the airplane, bring it back down to land. And so while we didn't exactly predict that the rudder would be unstable, we anticipated that it was a risk on the aircraft, and we were prepared as a team to handle that that scenario.
Was there a time, you know, that was a time when the, not quite unexpected, you know, you had some idea that something like that might happen, but was there a time when you're doing a first flight and you're flying along and it's like, wow, everything is just feels right. It's just, this is the way it should be. Can you tell us, has that ever happened? And if so, when was that?
It has, you know, I've had roughly a 50-50 success rate on my first flights, all of them successfully landing. The last first flight that I flew was the Model 401, and that aircraft really performed exactly as we had anticipated. We generally on our smaller aircraft do something called the high speed taxi, which may result in a runway flight where you might get an inch or two of air under the wheels prior to taking the aircraft on the maiden flight. And with the 401. On that high-speed taxi, I felt the main tires leave the ground, and it just felt perfectly balanced, very stable, and the aircraft was exactly what the engineers had told me that it would feel like. And so stepping into that first flight gave me just a tremendous amount of confidence. There was, you know, there was something else we were going to learn, but in terms of the basic aircraft, the handling qualities, it performed really well and resulted in a complete first flight card where we achieved all the objectives of the flight and were even able to join up with our photo chase and get some of the mandatory PR photos at the end to document the activity. A typical first flight profile, we'll do a low speed approach to landing with a wave off where we're just getting a feel for the aircraft in the landing environment. And that was really just wonderful to look out that window and see the entire company lining the runway. And, you know, it's really amazing to be part of that team and being able to take the airplane airborne and bring it back for both our employees and our customers.
Tell us about the 401. I'm sure a lot of people are not familiar with that.
Yeah, the 401 is one of our newer aircraft. We designed it for specific customer requirements. We've been using it as a test bed, testing unique capabilities and technologies on the platform.
And for those people who haven't seen it, it kind of looks like a cross between a Vision Jet and an F-117 altogether. It's a pretty amazing aircraft.
It's one of those airplanes where when we take it on the road, we stop for fuel, and it generally clears the FBOs. All the fuelers and line boys come out and want to know what kind of airplane it is and where they can get one.
You know, something I'm curious about is that when you have a – I know you have all these companies that you are obviously building for, and – well, I know we can't talk about all of them, but can you give us, our listeners, a sort of a briefing on what a customer might call and say, hey, I want an airplane that looks like the White Knight Tour, and I want it to look like this and do this, and what should we build, and can you build? I mean, how do you know you can even accomplish what they want? How do they even know what they want?
That's been an interesting thing for me to learn in the last year. And I think a lot of the place that Scaled adds value there is really helping the customer define those requirements. So we would strongly advise they don't tell us, I want an airplane that looks like this. It's like, what do you want it to do? What's your mission? and give us a trade space then. And a lot of times we'll do small design studies or trade studies for customers to help answer that question of what's this thing you want to accomplish? And then you design an airplane for that. I think Proteus is a great example of that, right? Proteus has now been flying for 25 years, and it was originally designed to carry a telecommunications dish. And the idea was to orbit above major cities and provide essentially high-speed internet. And so the aircraft was designed for that. It wasn't, I want you to build a dual-wing configuration and grow from here. It was, I need to do this thing. And that's really where that creativity and the ability of our engineers to just wow me kicks in. I think, yeah, Pete's been on that ride, of course, more than I will, so I will defer to him, too, to add anything.
Yeah, it's an exciting phase to be in the beginning of the program, because they're just, ideas flying, sticking. Some stick on the wall, some fall to the floor and just aren't possible. But it's a typical phase of our design process. You know, that being said, there are some programs where our customers do come to us with a OML in mind, and they may have very specific reasons why they need an aircraft to look the way it does. And then our design evolves from that, and we then, you know, we'll take that design and work and design the primary structure and the subsystems and a number of other things. So the real fun programs, though, are the ones where we do get that clean sheet and get to present our customers, as we invariably do, with a couple of options and see with bated breath to see which ones they pick.
And are they coming to you directly, or do they go to Northrop and Northrop says, hey, this is the division you should be working with?
Both happen. So it depends on exactly, it depends who the customer is, what their exact needs are. But we've got customers direct. We have customers through Northrop as well.
I'm thinking that if a customer goes to Scaled Composites and somebody else who's capable of designing an aircraft with a set of requirements or what they think their requirements are, and you and the other company both design something to meet that set of requirements, I just have this feeling like what comes out of Scaled is going to look completely different than what someone else would come up with. Is that because I've, sort of been, drinking the Scaled Kool-Aid for too many years now? Or is there some reason why...
I knew there was something.
There's something. some reason why the aircraft, for the most part, from Scaled, just have unique looks. Why is that?
Well, I can maybe summarize it just based on my experience growing up as a young engineer and test pilot with Bert. Is one of Bert's geniuses were that he may have a solution to a technical problem, and it may have worked perfectly well on the aircraft, the previous aircraft program. He would often throw that design in the trash and try something a new and unique way. And he did that because he was never satisfied with the designs that he came up with. And he was always looking for a better way to do something. And so, if that's one of the traits of Bert that has a strong legacy here at the company, is that desire to always try something different within bounds to see if there's a better way to do something. I think personally, that's why I think our airplanes are so unique and different, as we give our teams the creative flexibility to try something that has never been tried before.
And when you say Bert, it's probably unlikely that our listeners might not know, but in case somebody doesn't know, we're talking about Bert Rattan, who is one of the most amazing aeronautical engineers and designers ever in the world.
Bert really was a prolific designer, and it was just a great experience, a great honor to be able to work with him, work under him, and learn with the rest of the company how to design, build, and test aircraft.
Is there anything new that you're working on that you can tell us about? And if not, that's perfectly fine.
No, it's not. We want to know anyway.
Yeah, we won't tell anybody. It's just us friends here.
Yeah.
How about I answer half your question, say, yes, there's new things we're working on.
Great.
what I can say, and maybe to tease a little bit more, our corporate average is a first flight a year, and we're coming up on a year anniversary of our last first flight. And so it'll be really exciting to see what might roll out the door by the end of the year timeframe.
What's the typical design time for a new airframe? Is that a five-year thing, or what would you say in general it takes to come up with a new design for a new project?
You know, it really depends on the ultimate complexity and requirements that the program has. We've designed some airplanes in as little as 8 months, and then others, you know, the world's largest wingspan aircraft took quite a bit longer than that. And so we size the aircraft and the program according to the airplane's complexity and the requirements. And so one of the things that may not be well understood within the industry even is many of our aircraft are designed to test a very specific feature or design concept. They may not be a complete solution. And as an experimental airplane, with our customers' help, we may focus on a key technology area as a risk reduction for maybe a certification program or future development effort, or just to see whether some new technology even works. It's been thought of in the lab, and they want to go see if it works in the aircraft. And so we often can take what I would call is smart shortcuts in how we design our airplanes in order to meet those very specific program requirements.
Hmm. Well, we have kind of a favorite question that we like to ask because our audience ranges from quite young to older than Rob. And
I'm not sure that's possible.
Sorry, Rob.
And it's going to get worse next Tuesday because it's my birthday.
Oh,
we'll
save that for later.
Okay. But the question is, especially for the younger folks listening, for those who might listen to this or aspire to someday work in a company like Scaled Composites, something exciting in aviation like that, do you have any advice for them in terms of how they should develop their education, their career? How do you position yourself to become Pete Seybold or Greg Morris?
First, buy a T6, and that'll get you started. Yeah, okay.
For me, it's just be incredibly lucky. But I will the single defining trait of everybody I've seen at Scaled is just an incredible passion for this. If you are just passionate about airplanes and this is what you know you need to do, this is the place to be. And there's a lot of different ways to get there, right? We actually really like employees with non-traditional paths. That adds a lot of value and brings that diversity in every sense of the word to the company, which provides an enormous amount of value of that diversity of ideas. Employees who are maybe even on their second career, maybe it's a career change, have done something first. That's great. They can bring all that background to the table. So be passionate and then just find the path that's right for you to pursue whatever that passion is. And that's why it's an amazing place to work for that reason.
Pete, if you weren't doing this, what would you be doing?
Oh, that is a hard question. I am truly an engineer and tinkerer at heart, and the technologies and interest areas of mine are pretty broad, and I'm always trying to learn something new. You know, to follow up both on this question and the earlier question, you know, the advice that I would give somebody is be inquisitive and don't just accept that somebody's going to spoon feed you information. You need to set out to go find it yourself and do the research yourself and learn, maybe even the hard way, by breaking things and taking things apart and not being able to put them back together. But that builds character, that builds that interest in understanding how all things work. And in the end, you know, the real trait of an engineer here at Scaled is just always be willing to roll up your sleeves and find a way to get the job done and make the project and the team successful.
You know, I've got to tell you guys this. You know, we all have our non-geek friends that don't get aviation, and we always get some strange questions. And I had one once where somebody said, "That white knight, where the heck did that come from? How could that possibly?" And I've always explained it as, and I'm sure you've heard something like it, when a B-52 Stratofortress and a P-38 Lightning really love each other, that's when, and it's just my favorite way to describe it. It's a beautiful airplane.
Hey, Greg, what's the coolest airplane as a test pilot or engineer or whatever that you've flown?
I'm super fortunate in that I actually still get to put my test pilot back on sometimes at scale and work for Pete as one of our test pilots still. And I'd say I think Ares and Proteus are still two of my favorites. Ares, you know, single engine. Jet Canard, designed as a light attack aircraft initially in the late 80s and early 90s. Single JT-15, inlets on the left, had a 25-millimeter gun originally on the right that's been repurposed as a payload bay. Fascinating, neat airplane. Pete and I have got some good core memories of flying left turns with Pete at 50,000 feet and Proteus with me in the right seat running a payload, watching the sunrise. And that's just, it's incredibly fortunate, you know, and you're watching those early morning arrivals into LAX coming just south of R-25-15, 20,000 feet below you. It's pretty cool.
That's what I've always wanted, to be able to fly an airplane with a machine gun on it. You know, there's so many ways I could have used that.
The gun's not on Ares anymore, but it was. There's videos on YouTube of that. I think Doug Shane shooting on the range back in the day, I believe.
So after you design something and a customer wants to move it to production, does that then move to another part of the company?
A lot of times, I think really what Scaled is great at, right, are those demonstrators, right? Like Pete said, proving the concept out of how do you do something. And often that means we will not necessarily engineer for manufacture. We will engineer to get that demonstrator produced as rapidly as possible. And so that's a lot of times where the partnership and the ownership of Northrop becomes very valuable. We can transition that program, sometimes still retain part of it, and then help support them as that transitions into something that's going to be manufactured.
Well, that's kind of interesting. So a demonstrator rarely actually makes it into full production. It just becomes kind of the basis for designing something slightly different that does go into production?
Yeah, that is correct. You know, in the world of certified aircraft, a true production prototype would be fully conforming, meeting all the FAA design requirements, and be one of the first aircraft that would be used as part of very extensive FAA type cert verification process. Oftentimes, our projects are in the phase before that, where we're just testing out the shape, the basic concept of the aircraft. The aircraft would be non-conforming. You know, the structure may not be certifiable, but it can be built very quickly and meet our customers' goals. So that's just one example where a proof of concept airplane might be utilized in the furtherance of a larger type of project.
So that's a key to your speed and being able to turn out things quickly. You don't have to meet all the FAA requirements, so you can kind of move faster.
Most of our aircraft are designed with the FAR requirements in mind, or at least the military mil-spec equivalent. And where we can benefit is that we don't have to ultimately show compliance to those regulations. And so that allows us to design a test program where we design to the regulations and the requirements as a certified aircraft, but we have the latitude under the FAA's experimental airworthiness process. If we don't meet the requirements, we can often take note, take the data, provide that feedback to engineering, but most of the time we're still able to achieve the primary goal of the project.
Well, now, do you take any aircraft up to AirVenture at all?
We have in the past, yeah. So I think last was 2017, I want to say. Is that right?
Yeah, White Knight 2, we flew on one of its first cross-country flights, direct Mojave to AirVenture, quite a trip.
Do you guys still have NC-51, the Starship?
No, Scale does not have a Starship. Beautiful airplane, though. I've had a chance to fly one. Our friend Rob Scherer, one of the last remaining Starships in the world, continues to fly that. And that was a fun honor to be able to fly that unique airplane.
Gorgeous airplane.
Yeah, yeah, very much so.
So you guys build all these great scale models of the aircraft before you actually produce the large one, right? Stop laughing. So what do you do with all the scale models?
And can you send them to Rob with the hat?
Once you're...
Yeah. So
you guys, what do you think? I'm that shallow? Come on. I'm okay. I'm sorry. I missed your answer, Greg.
No, we've got some good scale models on the boardroom here. Honestly, for now, we'll use 3D printing a lot for that. But it's just, you know, that's something we'll do, iterating rapidly through design concepts. Just sometimes getting something in your hand helps quite a bit. There's a couple on my conference table in my office.
3D printing really changed your creation of those models. I mean, in the old days, somebody had to do what kind of carve and cut and do all the other things, right, to make a scale model.
Yeah, you know, and we still do hand carving of some of our prototypes and models, but 3D printing, additive manufacturing really has allowed us to take some different approaches to how we design or even prototype ourselves. You know, while we're building prototype aircraft, oftentimes we're still in the shop prototyping a new concept, you know, a new way to build a structural load path or a wing attach or, you know, some unique electronic component. So the new advances in additive manufacturing have just allowed us to be that much more effective and efficient in our work.
Sure. All right. Greg, if people want to learn more about scaled composites, well, there's the website, scaled.com, right? Is that the best place to go? Are there other places where we can learn more?
Yeah, the scaled.com is definitely the best place. And then we've got some social media presence as well, Facebook, LinkedIn.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you, Greg.
Do you just throw the models out that you don't use in a particular...
I sense an ulterior motive here, Rob. Is this, yeah, what's dry? Let's see. Let's, but there's a definitely, we're talking hats, we're talking models.
He doesn't give up, does he?
Hey, you know what?
I see Rob has a lot of models on his desk behind him.
He's clearly extorted the guest for those, I think.
Whole slew more over here. And, yeah, anyway.
I think he's into his third last question. That's what I've noticed here.
Yeah. All right. Greg and Pete, thanks so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
It was our pleasure. Thank you very much for having us.
Absolutely. Thanks. Thanks for everything and really enjoyed sharing our journeys.
Great. We did. We enjoyed hearing them.
Yeah, really. Thanks for being with us. Great meeting you guys.
Thank you.
On to the news. And I can hear David. He's not here tonight as we record this, but I can hear him in my head.
You can hear that groan?
Not more Boeing stories, but, you know, we can't. We have to.
Well, being that
that's where the acronym came from. I thought that was pretty cool, actually.
So I didn't get David's acronym. Story.
You got to be something me.
Okay, I got it. All right. This is from the Seattle Times. FAA to Boeing. Develop a plan to fix your quality issues within 90 days. So, Rob, it sounds like the FAA has sort of put their foot down and told Boeing what they need to do in order to address some quality issues.
It's actually a unique timing with this because, you know, Mike Whitaker's been in the job for 5 months, I think, or 4 months. And this is no small challenge for the FAA to face these safety, these quality issues with, you know, the largest aerospace manufacturer in the country. And it's as if it's a perfect storm of quality and money and regulations and complaints and everything all kind of coming together at one time. And the story was interesting because it mentioned that the FAA did not give the Boeing folks an or if kind of thing, like, you know, do it in 90 days or. So I think the fact that they didn't do that and the fact that this is the first time I can ever remember the feds telling anybody this kind of thing, I think Mr. Whitaker's real serious about this, and it should be, and it's about time.
Well, and I want to mention that he was the deputy administrator back when the Boeing 737 MAX debacle occurred, and I think both he and former administrator Huerta felt probably a little bit burned, and I suspect that Mr. Whitaker has learned, you know, a lot from that experience, and he's not going to let that happen again. So I think we're going to see a much tougher FAA this time around, and rightfully so.
Yeah, yeah. Whitaker said, Boeing must commit to real and profound improvements. Making foundational change will require a sustained effort from Boeing's leadership, and we are going to hold them accountable every step of the way with mutually understood milestones and expectations. So, this is pretty plain.
But as Rob said, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of teeth to it. It's like, if you don't do that, we're going to be very cross with you. You know, there's...
I didn't mean to imply that it didn't have any teeth. I think it does. And I think it's... I think that those teeth are implied, that you guys have pushed it as far as you're going to go. And you don't want to see what happens if you don't come up with some really good answers in 90 days. In fact, because they were going to give them 6 months, and then they backed off of that and said, no, we're going to give you 3 months. And so I think he's really serious about this.
Yeah, I think so too. It sounds that way to me.
And thank goodness for that, right? I mean, this is a serious thing, and that's the way it needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, yeah. I think an episode or two ago, we talked about the deferred prosecution agreement and a piece that we saw that was speculating that if this door panel incident falls under this 2021 deferred prosecution agreement with Boeing, and after the two fatal 737 MAX crashes, that, Micah, that this thing could really unravel for Boeing in a big way.
Yeah, the DOJ is now looking at this, the midair blowout on Alaska Airlines, and they are very concerned, and there's all sorts of different things going on with it. But what is interesting is that if the DOJ starts prosecuting over an accident, this is one of the things that we've talked about on several different occasions, that when you start prosecuting over accidents, then the investigation sort of lingers, and it doesn't give sometimes the company or the pilot an opportunity to improve or learn from what they did. And we've never in this country prosecuted a company or a pilot over an accident in the past that I can think of. This happened in Brazil with the what was that crash that took place in the jungle when they the
midair collision between an Embraer and something else, as I recall.
Yeah.
You know, the pilots ended up leaving Brazil and wouldn't be extradited there if they'd be faced prosecution. The last two paragraphs of this article that was in the Seattle Times, and it looks like the Seattle Times is really the paper of record when it's covering Boeing, talks about how if the aviation accident investigation leads to criminal charges, the National Transportation Safety Board, which holds primary responsibility for investigating the accidents, is sort of undermined. And the criminal probe has potential to totally derail or delay the NTSB's probe of the door plug incident because it becomes a criminal prosecution. So evidence changes and there's not a way to really investigate as there might have been in the past.
And if all that weren't enough, there's a little spat going on between Boeing and one of its engineering unions, the Society of Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace. Boeing has filed an unfair labor practice complaint against the union. Now, this is only with 23 flight technical and safety pilots, those in the flight operations group. Here we go with, you know, one more newsmaker for Boeing.
Well, this also relates to the safety culture in Boeing, because what's happening is that the safety pilots, the engineering and safety pilots, are being paid, or so they claim to be paid, 28% less than the Boeing's corporate pilots. Now, they're flying the same aircraft, but they're getting paid 28% less. And one might say that a safety engineering pilot's job is maybe more critical than the corporate pilot. So the spokesman, the executive director of Boeing's white-collar union, the Society of Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace, in talking about this, has said that with the entire world focused on the Boeing safety culture, it was truly startling to see how differently Boeing leadership values the safe operation of its product versus the comfort of its executives, because the executive pilots are being paid 28.6% more than the safety pilots. And it turns into another safety issue.
Boeing really just does not get it. They really don't. One side does not know what the other side's doing. And, of course, Boeing is also going to be facing very soon, starting next month, the machinists in Seattle are going to start negotiating for a new contract. And the machinists have not forgotten that their old pals at Seattle wanted to dump the union years ago. And so went looking for a new place to build a factory that could be non-union, which is what ended up in South Carolina. And so I think it's going to be very interesting. Again, all of this seems to kind of be coming together. And will Mr. Calhoun and his pals survive? That remains to be seen.
And what's interesting is that Boeing, again, is the union's been complaining for years that Boeing has been outsourcing their job. They've systematically, this is a quote, they've systematically hollowed out the Society of Professional Engineers pilots group, replacing the in-house Boeing pilots with contractors. And again, this is to quote the spokesman, the resulting degradation in expert advice given to Boeing's airline customers is another example of the safety culture problem highlighted by the FAA. It's just a really scary thing going on at Boeing. And do any of you guys have HBO?
No, used to.
HBO, there's a show on Sunday nights called Last Week Tonight with John Oliver.
Oh, yes, of course.
And last night, there was recording this on Monday. You'll be able to catch it on YouTube. And I put it in the shout outs, but John Oliver did a whole piece on Boeing. He has talked about everything that we talked about with Boeing over the past several months, narrowed it down to about 30 minutes and made it much more entertaining and funny. And it's just, I watched it. I laughed. I cried. John Ostrower is quoted in there. We can see him on the show. Dominic Gates is there. But it turned it into a funny bit, but it's letting the public know really what's gone on. He traced it all the way back to the merger with McDonnell Douglas. And it's absolutely beautiful. We'll have a link in the show notes. If you haven't seen it, watch it, because it tells you everything that we've been talking about for months and months and months and does it in a way that makes you laugh and makes you frightened.
So do you think that John Oliver is a Geeks fan? Perhaps he's a listener.
I wouldn't be surprised if one of his writers is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one thing that I didn't really anticipate, this is a report in the Wall Street Journal that Boeing is in talks to buy Spirit AeroSystems. Of course, Spirit AeroSystems came from Boeing a number of years ago. But they're apparently having preliminary discussions, the two companies are. In fact, they've hired some bankers to explore strategic options, it says, which I think means look at the numbers, see if it makes sense from a financial standpoint. Spirit is also at the same time looking at selling its Ireland unit that makes parts for Airbus. But both companies have apparently confirmed that they are having merger discussions. They may not go anywhere, or Spirit AeroSystems may come back inside Boeing.
There's a new story that's come out since this particular one came out, and it said that Spirit is in talks not just with Boeing, but with Airbus. Yeah. So Boeing, ironically, may find that the company that they spun off 19 years ago might go to their competitor, which would be, you know, really sad, because obviously they do a whole lot of work for Boeing, and I'm sure it does make you know, some of the executives wonder, why did we spin this off if we're now trying to get it back? And of course, now we've also potentially you know, set it up for our main competitor to buy it.
But do you suppose this could be a move to sort of spin things around and for Boeing to be able to say, we sold it off and look how they degraded and destroyed our program, and now we're going to take it back so we can fix it. And they can blame it all on Spirit and saying that, you know, we're going to fix it now. It kind of seems to, I mean, I could be totally wrong, but that's something I would try.
That kind of sounds like, you know, PR spin. I don't expect that. I suspect that they really think that it makes sense from a business standpoint to bring it back within the company.
Well, if they intend to you know, be true to the FAA's demands that they get their quality issues fixed, I mean, the relationship with Spirit has got to improve because they've had God knows how many defects coming from the aircraft and the components built in Wichita. And I can't think of a better way to do it. And of course, Spirit is a bit down on its luck. So maybe they'll get a good price.
Well, or Spirit may get a very good price if they play Airbus against Boeing.
Mm. Yeah, or it could end up with neither of them wanting Spirit. All right, let's move away from Boeing and Spirit Aerosystems. And
oh.
Yeah, I know, disappointment all around, I'm sure. There's a company that has been retrofitting Robinson R-66 helicopters with a proprietary operating system. And this is a very interesting company that's doing some interesting things, Rob.
Skyrise has been taking R-66s and modifying them in a way that, in fact, Max will be better to explain this. They get rid of one of the controls and they basically make it a fly-by-wire helicopter, and it'll do all the same things that the old copter will do, but it will do it more efficiently. And it looks at some of the tricks. Max, when you were getting your rating, you know, last year, I mean, auto rotations, hovering, those are all challenging for a new pilot, aren't they?
Oh, sure. You figure both feet are in operation, both hands are in operation, and there's in an auto rotation, all of those things are working together. And by the way, they're actually eliminated more than one control. The pedals are gone, as I understand, and so it's really just a single stick instead of pedals, cyclic, and collective. So they've also got two touchscreen controllers in there. And so they've really made this incredibly easy to fly. So easy, in fact, that they're saying that if someone gets their helicopter rating in their new Skyrise 1, there will be a limitation placed on their license that they can't fly traditional helicopters, which makes total sense because this helicopter is probably going to be a lot easier to fly.
So I guess the next step would be just eliminate the pilot completely.
Oh, I'm sure that's been thought of. You know, to me, the really big thing about this story is that they said that at $1.8 million, this will be the lowest cost certified helicopter that's certified by IFR for IFR flight by a factor of 2, which when you think about it, you know, that means to get into an IFR helicopter, you're looking at around $3.6 million. And I think this is going to be a huge opportunity for them because a lot of different operators would love to have helicopters with IFR capability. And as I've mentioned in the past, and no Robinsons are certified for flight into the clouds. You've got to stay visual the entire time. So this is a huge market opportunity for them.
I've got two questions for you. You know, when I'm reading the article, it says that the proprietary system offers an IFR-capable, aircraft-agnostic, triple-redundant fly-by-wire system. Now, IFR-capable I get completely. Triple-redundant fly-by-wire system I understand. Aircraft-agnostic, it can go into any helicopter? I don't exactly know what that means. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I think you hit upon it right there. I think their OS and the electronics that they've got along with it, they've probably designed it in a way that they can pick it up and stick it into a different helicopter. So, yeah, that's what it sounds like to me.
And is the R-66 basically an R-44 with a turboshaft?
Yeah, I mean, in the crudest way, definitely you could say that. It's a little bit bigger, a little bit more capable, but yes, it's twice as expensive because it's got a turbine engine essentially in it.
Great. And if you're going to go into the clouds, that's what I would rather have.
Yeah. Well, and also the redundant autopilot. I don't recall the exact certification requirements, but the FAA says something along the lines of you need a fully dual redundant autopilot or something like that to certify a helicopter to go on the clouds. I know I'm not quite right on that, but that's sort of what it says.
Yeah, I see that the R-66, it uses a Rolls-Royce turboshaft, R-300 turboshaft. All right, we've been talking about the V-22 Ospreys, and Micah, I think we have some news on that front.
Yeah, they have been grounded for quite some time, ever since the crash in Japan, and next week the military has said that we were going to let them fly again. Now, there's an interesting take on this because the article, which comes to us from the Aviationist, it says that the incident with the Japan crash that took place November 29th is still under investigation. The Air Force said that it identified the cause of the crash, but it hasn't been able to determine the reason of the failure. Mm-hmm. So with that being the case, it's interesting that they're going to be coming back online. Now, apparently, I guess, because they know the cause, they can test it, I guess, I suppose, and see what's going on and do a little more maintenance and make sure that the same thing doesn't happen again. They're going to do it through additional safety checks and more conservative operations, I guess, lighter loads. And they're hoping that with that, they'll mitigate the known material failures, according to the article.
Gee, I've forgotten. Who builds the Osprey?
Boeing Vertol.
Oh, okay. I just didn't remember.
Yeah, exactly. Out of suburban Philadelphia.
The rumors out there, and it's just rumors from some sources that we have, said that it has something to do with the nacelles separating from the wing, which could certainly be a real problem, I would think. But again, these are the only rumors. I have nothing other than rumors about that, but it's really fascinating.
And it's worth mentioning, too, that production line is slated to shut down in 2026, given the lack of money in the budget for them. And so I think probably the – oops, crap.
We lost Max T.
Well, we'll see. But I know where he was. He was talking about the production line.
Yeah.
So they were planning on shutting it down anyway?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, the end of production is in sight based on lack of demand.
I wonder if Boeing made any money on these things.
Good question. I don't know how large the fleet is. That would be a clue.
I don't think it's that large.
No. All right. Well, let's go on. We have an item. This is from AvWeb. Rob, is the pilot shortage over?
Well, it depends. If you read the comments to these kinds of stories, it would certainly seem like it. But Southwest is slowing its hiring. They did not give a really solid reason for why they are doing that, but they're not the only company that is slowing down. And people are saying, oh, see, I told you there was no pilot shortage. I think people that say that have no idea of how many thousands and thousands and thousands of new pilots have been hired at the major airlines in the United States in the last 5 years. I mean, an ungodly amount. So it's as if, to me, at least when I look at it, well, we kind of knew this was coming. I mean, it was a matter of when. You can't hire indefinitely. I mean, there just aren't enough aircraft. I think that was one other issue that someone raised in the comments that I thought was good, was that Southwest, of course, is a pure 737 airline. And now how many of the aircraft that Southwest has on order they have taken delivery of, I'm not really sure. But is this slowing down related to Boeing? I don't know. They don't give us enough information in the story to know that. But again, I mean, we have hired a lot of pilots at Southwest. I thought I was checking my one of my sources, and I thought he'd have something for me before we went on the air, but he didn't. But it's a lot of pilots. They've hired many thousands.
I see here that, according to FAPA.aero, showed that Southwest hired nearly 2,000 pilots in 2023. That's a big number. And they expect to hire 345 pilots this year, 2024. So it's a big drop, but like you say, an airline has to match passenger capacity needs with aircraft availability, with pilot and crew availability. So all these things have to line up. And I don't know. Like you say, Rob, if there's, you know, one of these is not matching up with expected capacity growth, then, you know, you may have to adjust the others. It could be adjusting the number of pilots you're hiring.
And it also says Southwest isn't the first to slow down on hiring. Spirit did for completely different reasons than anybody else, but also FedEx and UPS have scaled back some. So at the time it was going to happen, and we'll see where it goes.
Well, Micah, one thing that's not going to happen apparently is the JetBlue-Spirit merger.
Yeah, it was announced as we record the show the day that this Monday that the JetBlue and Spirit appeal has been denied and they will not be merging. The Justice Department has blocked it. And we'll have to see how that goes. What the interesting part in the article, at least the piece that I found particularly interesting, is that JetBlue said after, noting the judge's decision that the appeal was required under the terms of the merger agreement, that if it was denied, they were required to appeal it, which they did, probably not as forcefully as they might have, but they saw the writing on the wall.
Yeah, but now what happens to Spirit?
Well, their stock price went down.
JetBlue went up, Spirit went down, and we know that Spirit's not hiring, so...
Could be tough times ahead.
Maybe Frontier will go back in there.
Who knows?
Yeah. That's a possibility. Ah.
And welcome back.
What's up with the geeks? Rob, have you got something for us?
Yes, a couple of things. Well, first of all, since we had these great guests on tonight, I wanted to share a story that I wrote some years ago after Greg Morris, that was one of the guests tonight, tried to check me out in an L-39 Albatross, and it was a hell of a lot of fun. He was still here in Chicago at the time, and he tried to make me a jet pilot, a fighter pilot, and I don't know that I really would have passed muster. I was not, you know, fighter pilots are used to just yanking and banking, and everything's fast, and if you're not pulling six Gs in a turn, you're a wimp, and I think I wimped out on him. No, but anyway, I just wanted people to go take a look at it. We posted it at JetWine before. But another thing, I'm working on a new book, and I'd like to ask the help of some of our listeners if they'd be interested. If you've ever had an experience as you've been gaining experience as a pilot, has there ever been something you've really learned a great deal from that kind of happened by accident? I don't mean you had an accident, but in the sense that, boy, I wish my instructor had told me that a long time ago. I never understood this thing. But for me, I think one of my earliest memories was that one of my instructors, and when I learned to fly, we learned to fly in champs, and we were front and back seating, kind of like a Piper Cub. And doing the first couple of landings, and we got close to the runway, and he said, "Flare, flare!" And wham! And we hit the ground, and I thought the wings were going to break off. And after we taxied back in, he said, "What the hell's wrong with you? Why didn't you flare?" And I said, "What's a flare?" I mean, he'd never explained it to me, and so I didn't know what he was yelling at me about. I never forgot that. But I'm just thinking maybe some of the folks in listener land might have some stories that might be interesting to other people. And they can reach out to me personally at rob@jetwine.com, and I will be happy to follow up. And that's all I'm saying for tonight.
Cool. All right. Well, Max Trescott is back online. Max, you dropped off there, but I'm glad you made it back.
I've made it back through the internet. Hey, I just want to follow up on Rob's comment about flare. One of the things I learned last year when I got my helicopter certificate is that flare has a very different meaning in the helicopter world. And so I really want to caution anyone who's a flight instructor for fixed wing. If you're helping transition a helicopter pilot into an airplane, be very careful if you tell that pilot to flare, because that's something that typically happens at the end of an auto rotation rotation, and it is a massive pitch up, which is huge compared to the small amount of raising of the nose that we do in airplanes. So just be aware that that word has very different meanings between the helicopter world and the fixed wing world.
In the English teacher world, I was would have just handed Rob a Papermate felt tip pen.
that works as well.
Yeah.
See, I thought you were going to say a road flare.
Yeah, that's where I thought it was going to go.
Yeah, and I just want to mention that on Aviation News Talk this week, we talked in detail about the preliminary accident report that came out on the Challenger 604 that crashed onto I-75 outside of Naples. It turns out one of the listeners pointed out to me that there was another Challenger which had a dual engine flame out 30 years ago. So I was able to pull that report up, and a couple similarities between it, but still it's not at all clear what happened. But we talked about the two accidents and what things were similar.
Interesting. Okay, Micah, what's new with you?
Well, The Journey is Reward, episode 65, has come out this week, and Brian and I talk about his experience flying Alaska Airlines up to Seattle from down in L.A. and how he felt about flying on an Alaska 737 MAX 9.
Well, this is episode 65, huh?
Episode 65. Can't believe we've come along that far.
Yeah. All right. We have a few shout-outs, or maybe one shout-out. Micah.
Well, you know, this isn't so much an aviation story, but it's certainly an aviation podcast story. Bob Heil, who's an audio hero of mine, he passed this week. He became a ham radio operator at the age of 13, and being frustrated with the quality of sound and the microphones that he was working on, he created the Heil Audio Company, perhaps best known currently for the PR40 microphone, a microphone I wish I had, and I'm so jealous of Max Flight because that's what he uses, best microphone around for audio voice. But he also created the talk box that Peter Frampton made famous in his 1976 album, I think, where you hear him kind of whining on. And he created the sound systems for the Grateful Dead and the quadraphonic sound system for the Who Quadrophenia Tour. He was 83 years old and just passed. And great guy. He used to do a show with Leo Laporte on ham radio operations, and you could just hear how much he loved talking about audio and everything that he knew about it. And boy, again, if you're a podcaster and you want to spend $350 on a microphone, go for that PR40. Wow.
And how he came to produce the sound system or put together the sound system for the Grateful Dead and then ultimately the Who and so forth. It's a fascinating story. It's almost an accidental coming together of Bob Heil and those groups. The Wikipedia page for Bob Heil, I think, has a pretty good recounting of the story, but there's some others out there if you're kind of interested in rock music and music and performances and how the sound systems were created. Look for that. Bob Heil was quite a guy, and everybody loved him. You know, easy to get along with, and just a real joy.
Just an amazing engineer. I mean, you can't. The microphone that you're using, Max, that PR40, you can't, it's, like I said, it's about $350. You can spend $2,000 on a microphone and not get anything that's going to sound better. It's unbelievable.
These are nice mics. All right. On to some listener mail. We've had this for a couple of weeks. We ran out of time. No, I ran out of batteries last time. That's what happened. Yeah, so we just had to sort of finish. Our friend Sam Abelsamid sent us an email and following up on some of our GPS spoofing conversation. Sam is an automotive journalist, I guess I would call him. He's got the Wheel Bearings podcast, wheelbearings.media, and a number of other places online. You'll find Sam and his writings. But we talked about GPS and the fact that those kinds of systems exist in other countries. And we call it GPS, but Sam points out the generic term for all of these systems is GNSS, Global Navigation Satellite System, which we in the United States call GPS. There's the European Galileo system, the Russian GLONASS, set of satellites that do this. And in China, they have the Baidu GNSS system. And he also points out that it's actually not that hard to switch between them, that virtually all modern smartphones, he says, contain multiple GNSS receivers, including GPS, Galileo, and GLONASS. He says, I don't know if aircraft include multiple receivers, but there's no technical reason they couldn't. However, it all can be spoofed or jammed in similar ways. I mean, it's important to know that the way these systems work is they're passive, right? There's no two-way communication. They're just basically broadcasting signals, and the hardware and software and the GPS receiver in your phone or you know whatever the device is doing all of the processing and determining location based on those. So it really doesn't matter whether you're using the U.S. GPS system or the European Galileo system. They all work. And some devices actually, as Sam points out, have the ability to switch between them depending on where they can get the most satellites and that kind of a thing. But then he also points out that the concept of spoofing GNSS is not new and was demonstrated by some security researchers with a Tesla back in 2019. And there's an article, we'll put a link in the show notes. This is from GPS World. It's Tesla Model S and Model 3 vulnerable to GNSS spoofing attacks. So it's been around a while, and spoofing is spoofing. However you're using GPS for location services, it can be spoofed or jammed, as we talked about in the case with El Al.
Yeah, and if you haven't heard Wheel Bearings podcast, give it a listen if you're into automobiles. Sam Albusamed is just an amazing guy, great information, and really good at what he does.
Yeah. And he listens to our podcast, which is...
He has no taste, but he's still...
Don't say that. Okay. And then another email we got from a listener. Now, this is pretty long, but it's fairly interesting. This is on the topic of space debris and old satellites that came up. And this was in regard to a Japanese company that was using or proposing to use a ground laser to vaporize space junk. And so our listener says, as mentioned, NORAD does indeed keep the official catalog of space objects and publishes the tracked objects with regular updates. The TLEs, which stand for two-line element, which is a reference to these being intended for Fortran lines, but these once were called two-card elements in reference to punch cards. They are a very compact pile of numbers which give parameters related to the Keplerian elements, not actually the classical elements, that describe the shape of the orbit at a given epoch time. This can be plugged into a software program to project where the satellite will be. As of this email, he says the highest object number was 58,994. This is a one-up numbering system with a rocket body for Sputnik being 00001, and Sputnik itself being 00002, which goes against the current convention of the primary payload getting the lowest available number. He says there are far fewer than this tracked, since many objects have re-entered. However, there are a large number too small to track. In December 2022, there were around 32,750 being tracked. Says current totals are hard to find. Most are junk, not active satellites. So, and this is what the topic was about, space objects colliding is a very real concern. Largely, satellites are protected by the fact that space is big, and we have been mostly lucky. If a satellite is still working and has a functional propulsion system and is predicted it will come close to hitting something, it is up to the satellite operator to change the orbit to avoid collision. However, not all satellites are still working. Some items have always been debris, like rocket bodies, and some satellites either never had a propulsion system or run out of fuel. For all of that stuff, that is at the whim of physics, we just hope. A few years back, luck ran out for a functional Iridium satellite, which collided with an old dead Russian one, which marked the first and only collision between two full satellites, but small debris collisions are more common. The Kessler syndrome describes chain reaction collisions that could unfold if whole satellites colliding make debris fields that cause more collisions. So, how do we manage satellites to try to keep them from being a problem at the end of life? The rules are sort of like the pirate code in Pirates of the Caribbean. They are more of a set of guidelines. If a satellite is low enough to decay in 20 years, you are considered a responsible space user who doesn't need to do anything. If you are way out in the geo ring, the geosynchronous satellites, it takes way more fuel than is reasonable to bring the satellite all the way back to Earth, so you're supposed to boost up a few hundred kilometers to not put the geo ring at risk. The discussion on the episode made this sound like this was putting it into a cislunar orbit, something where the Earth and the Moon's gravity are both at play. The boost above geo is still very much still in an Earth orbit. Cislunar debris is still a concern because things like the James Webb Space Telescope are out there. If the satellite falls between geo and the 20-year natural decay, it is supposed to save enough fuel at end of life to get low enough to naturally decay. However, in practice, satellites often break suddenly and can't be properly disposed of, and users don't want to stop using a multi-million dollar satellite that is still working and will not bring it down or up for geo when its fuel gets to bingo. So, that brings us to debris removal. The technical challenges are significant, but if those could be solved, debris removal is still a huge political issue. So here's the twist. If everyone and every country in space got along, we could remove debris. However, if your debris removal technology can dispose of a tumbling piece of junk, you will have no problem doing the same to a nice, stable, working one that belongs to someone you don't like. So anyone claiming peaceful debris removal is still going to be viewed by other countries as developing space weapons intended to kill their very, very expensive, multi-year-to-replace satellites. Destroying a satellite could be as big a deal as destroying a capital ship. So, whether a ground-based laser or something else, someone somewhere will really not like it. Japan developing this would likely draw the suspicion of Russia and China. So I think that's very interesting, and hadn't really contemplated the political implication of cleaning up satellite debris. So I want to thank our listener for sending that in.
Maybe we can learn more about that if and when we get somebody from the Space Force on with us, and I think that may be happening.
I think so. Maybe in a couple of weeks, I think, as I recall. Yeah, that'll be very exciting. All right. We want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We had two guests this episode, Greg Morris. He's the president at Scaled Composites. Also, we had Pete Siebold. He's the VP of Flight Operations for Scaled. And their website, of course, is scaled.com. As for us, we're at airplanegeeks.com. The direct link to the show notes for this episode is airplanegeeks.com/789, and our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. So, let's see, Rob Mark, where can folks find you online?
Well, usually they'll find me at any place that has Jetwine in the title or the suffix or anything like that, and also between the pages of various and sundry aviation publications around the nation.
Terrific. And Micah, how about you?
Well, you can find me on what used to be called Twitter, and that is Maine Fly is my ID there. Maine, like the state of Maine, M-A-I-N-E, Fly, Let's Go Fly, F-L-Y, May at Maine Fly. And also you can find me with our good friend, Pasadena Brian Coleman, on the Journey is a Reward podcast, and give that a listen. It's always a lot of fun. I'm going to be recording a new show tomorrow with a special guest that's a friend of the show.
Oh, cool. Can't wait for that. And finally, Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, if you're into general aviation or particularly pilot safety, check out aviationnewstalk.com. And if you want to send me a note, go to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact at the top of the page.
What about you, Max?
Well, you can find out where I hang out online if you tootle on over to 30,000feet.com. It lists where you can find me and a few other little goodies. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Night, everybody.
And for David, thanks for listening.